Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Welcome to The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Wednesday, April 7th. Today we hear how one of our community's treasures stands to be impacted, not just by the federal courts ordered by President Donald Trump, but by his tariffs. We also talk about the future of the historic Hawaii Theater, why soaring insurance costs have lawmakers looking to the state government to take over its operation. We learn why scientists are picking up after humpback whales, what mysteries can be solved from their stool. And coastal erosion is prompting emergency work to protect the land under an iconic hotel in Waikiki and make a seawall safer for public access. We'll give you a taste of locals' concerns as we plan to go live from the seashore tomorrow. Tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. One of the two legal cases that Hawaii is taking the lead on in President Donald Trump's second term scored a win late yesterday. A federal judge in Rhode Island issued a preliminary injunction to halt the elimination of the Institute of Museum and Library Services and two other agencies created and funded by Congress. We had talked to the Bishop Museum earlier in the day before the injunction was handed down. Janet Bullard is the Vice President of Advancement in Marketing Communications and also serves as the museum's acting government relations director. She told us the museum relies on 24 federal grants. It has an annual budget of about $26 million a year from private and public sources, which includes funding from the Institute of Museum and Library Services, as well as the National Science Foundation and National Endowment for the Humanities.
Currently, we have about 24 different federal grants, and they range from collections care to digitization of some of our objects. Like, for instance, we have a Hawaiian language newspaper project, digitizing every Hawaiian language newspaper in the state. We have projects such as native plant seed collection and storage, for the purposes of reforestation. We have grants that provide information on native plant species, endangered plant species, digitizing that, providing the metadata to the public. We had a particular grant that was providing mentorship to other small nonprofits and Native Hawaiian organizations that provided them with training on how to fundraise, how to write grants, how to seek grants, and then creating sort of a networking of peer learning and support. So that's one of the other grants. Digital infrastructure, because we are currently, one of our major initiatives is digitizing our 25 million plus collection objects so that they are accessible to the public more readily without having to come here to look at the object. So that was another grant. A lot of staff funding for collections care, research. So the types of grants that we received from the federal government were quite broad and quite extensive as well.
Well, what can you tell us about what has been immediately impacted?
So the IMLS, we had five grants. They were all canceled. We also received cancellation notices from the National Endowment for the Arts. We had a grant there that was canceled. The National Endowment for the Humanities, we had two grants there. Those are both canceled. The National Science Foundation grants are on pause and not getting funded. And so terminated grants, we have eight total thus far, and another eight through the National Science Foundation, which are no longer going to be funded.
I just imagine that those cuts are going to run really deep.
Yes, and the unfortunate thing is that these are all at the core of our mission to serve our community and perpetuating our culture and as well as preservation of our environment. So those have all been lost.
Can you tell us the dollar amount?
So confirmed terminated is about, thankfully we did draw down a portion, but is about a little over $500,000, $531,349 of terminated funding. And then the National Science Foundation, which will likely be terminated, no longer funded, is about $840,000. So it's significant impact for us, for sure. I think the biggest concern for us is the preservation of our staff, because a lot of the funding is to support the staff who is doing this active either research, collections care, and figuring out now how we can, and if we can, keep those valuable and talented staff members. So that is the most significant impact and immediate concern in order for them to continue to do this work. Can we financially support them as a nonprofit who is now losing funding?
So what percentage of your funding comes from federal grants?
About 7%.
And the rest is?
Through admissions, other state government, private foundations, individual donors, facility rentals, programming. So there are other sources of revenue, but our federal funding is definitely significant and allows us to do much needed work on behalf of our community, including supporting our staff.
And, you know, you just recently hosted the Micronesian Festival this past weekend, and you've got lots of, you know, things in the queue. I don't know. Are you having to cancel events like that or rethinking the strategy going forward?
I think it's forcing us to rethink everything that we're doing and prioritizing. We have been fortunate we've not had to cancel anything yet. Our community private funders have stepped up to support what they believe is important for our community. And so we're hopeful that we can continue to do what we're doing and doing everything possible to minimize the impact to the extent that we can.
I have to ask, would the tariff situation, would that affect you in any way?
Yes, it will. Much of our equipment, things like you don't even think about, alcohol to preserve our collection, the equipment, our HVAC, our environmental controls, those are all coming from other places. And so we are currently undergoing some major CIP improvements, IT infrastructure. Those are significant cost items that will be affected and likely increase from the what was originally budgeted. Even getting things like construction materials to help with our fire suppression. We're looking at even simple things like storage space. Those will all be affected through the tariffs.
I recall DJ Mailer was talking about the fire suppression system after Notre Dame burned, right? Everybody was just like, gosh, how do we protect our treasures? And I know that you just had some acquisitions to help with your snail population as well, the endangered snails. And of course, yeah, HVAC, you know, the air conditioning systems, the temperature control equipment that you need for collection care.
Yep, critical. So there are a lot of things that people don't realize are important for our primary purpose and our kuleana of caring for our collections that will be impacted by tariffs.
Is there anything that you can share with us? And I know you're going through a transition. You've got a new museum head coming on later this fall. But anything, any outreach or anything else that you folks are going to do to drive home what this museum means to the community?
For us, it's really just ensuring that we are still doing everything possible to serve the community, to provide the resources and the information that the community needs, to continue to do the biodiversity preservation work that we're doing, and really internally just prioritizing the work so that the most critical responsibilities that we have continue on so that we can continue to serve our community and be valuable to the state and really preserve our cultural history and natural history.
It is priceless.
Irreplaceable, yeah. please continue to support your nonprofits and things that institutions that are important to the perpetuation of our culture and to our environment and to our way of life here, because we are very fragile here in Hawaii.
That was Bishop Museum's Janet Bullard talking about the federal grants that it relies on for its collection care and other programs. A federal district judge ruled in favor of Hawaii late yesterday, which means the museum could have its funds from the Institute of Museum and Library Services possibly restored. In the preliminary injunction, the judge found that President Donald Trump's order was likely unconstitutional in that it tried to eliminate agencies funded and created by Congress. It's not clear if Trump will appeal or how soon any funding streams could be restarted. The AG's office says that the Institute of Museum and Library Services funds $1.5 million of the Hawaii State Library system budget. We did talk to State Librarian Stacey Aldrich last month about the potential impacts. Aldrich hailed a ruling, saying the Institute is vital to library services.
Support for HPR comes from Osher Lifelong Learning Institute for ages 50 and older, with courses designed to engage the mind and enrich lives. Classes begin June 2nd, OLLIUHM.org.
Tune in to HPR 2 on Monday at 8 p.m. as the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra, under the direction of Dane Lam, performs selections from Don Giovanni by Mozart. Featuring vocalists Leon Williams, Rachelle Durkin, Brian Minnick, Christopher Nazarian, Lori Rubin, Sophia Troncoso, and David Young. Don't miss this spectacular performance. That's 8 p.m. Monday on HBR2, sponsored by the Rice Partnership.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Chaminade University.
The Hawaii Theater turns 103 this year, but the future of the downtown Honolulu landmark is up in the air as the nonprofit revealed that rising insurance costs aren't something that it can sustain. So it's turning to lawmakers for help. HPR's Cassie Ordonio has been tracking the talks and joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so what's the latest?
So right now, the Senate Concurrent Resolution 131, which is introduced by Senator Carl Rose, who represents Chinatown, it was recently adopted last month. But you know how resolutions go. It's kind of an ask more than like a do so. But the next steps is for Senator Carl Rose to meet with Senator Chris Lee and other senators to meet with the governor's office to see whether he will consider acquiring or purchasing the property of Hawaii Theater, which is 103. Years old.
Right. They did a fabulous job of restoring it. But yeah, it's a shame that this insurance crisis is impacting its livelihood, right?
And Gregory Dunn, who's the president and CEO of the Hawaii Theater Center, the nonprofit, he said it's already expensive enough to upkeep the maintenance, but the rising insurance cost is continuing to balloon over the years.
With the property insurance, last year we could buy $1,000 of coverage and it would cost $2 for $1,000 of coverage. This year, that same $1,000 of coverage costs us $90. So if you think about in terms of if you're buying $50 million of coverage, we were paying $90,000 and it was a good amount of coverage for us to have to cover a loss of the theater building. This year, we could only afford $5 million of coverage. So we have less than 10% coverage on the theater building. So if something catastrophic happened, we would not have the funds available to rebuild or repair anything over the $5 million mark. And as myself as the president of the theater and then our board as fiduciaries that are responsible to ensure the preservation of the building, it's our responsibility to try and find a solution that will help ensure the building will be here for the future. And one of those is to reach out to the state and also to the city, which we have asked to find a solution. And at this point in time, the only viable solution we've found so far has been for the state to put forward the concurrent resolution to explore an acquisition of the building itself.
Yeah, it's scary to think that it's underinsured. I mean, you know, if there's a hurricane or some other, you know, tragic disaster, that we may not be able to rebuild it.
Exactly. And then as the infrastructure continues to age, it's going to be dilapidated and it still needs to undergo renovations as well. The bigger question is whether the state wants to invest or purchase another property, because that would mean the state would also need to pay for the property insurance. But what Gregory was telling me in interviews is that the nonprofit would still be able to do its basic maintenance of the theater and still be able to run it and pay for the other maintenance, like renovating the carpets that need to be replaced and the more than 1,400 seats. I did read in the resolution that the state had invested $30 million in public grants and assistance to renovate and preserve the theater, but that's just about it. So it's still that question of whether the state will consider purchasing the property or not. But community members who I spoke to, like Bob Armstrong, who sits on the Downtown China Neighborhood Board, he said that it would be sad to the community if something were to happen to the theater, if they could no longer continue operations. And, you know, this theater has a rich history in the downtown Chinatown neighborhood, located on Bethel Street. I know the building was built in 1922, 2 decades after the Chinatown fire after the bubonic plague. And that construction of the theater was postponed a few years back due to the 1910 Spanish flu pandemic. So it survived even the COVID-19 pandemic. So, I mean, this theater has a knack for survival. And when being in the theater, it has like this neoclassical style that was modeled after theaters. And Gregory Dunn is here talking more about the history of the theater.
The theater went through transition from silent movies to talking movies to vaudeville. There was a symphony that performed here at one point in time. We had opera that performed here. And then obviously Hawaiian music has always been a real key cultural component of offerings at the Hawaii Theater. Then when Consolidated Amusements began to move into entirely the movie business, the theater became primarily a movie house in the 30s and 40s. It catered to a lot of the military that were stationed in Hawaii during that time. You can see a lot of photos in the state archives of the Hawaii Theater from that time period. Then moving into the 50s and 60s, as theater started to get really tired and worn down, all of a sudden a major shift happened. People got TVs in their homes, and people didn't come to movies as much anymore. They also didn't want to come to Chinatown as much anymore, because the seedy nature of Chinatown had gotten grittier and grittier over time. And the Hawaii Theater then started showing karate films, and then also there was a period of adult entertainment that happened in the Hawaii Theater.
Yeah, so interesting history, but it is a beautiful venue. It'd be a shame to see it shut down.
It is, and the nonprofit says they're still going to continue to preserve and think of the longevity of the theater.
And did they talk to the city at all about, you know, playing a role in this?
Gregory did say that he talked to the city, but he said the most viable solution is to talk to the state and see if the state will consider acquiring the theater.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see what happens. But thank you so much, Cassie.
Thanks for having me.
That was HPR's Cassie Ordonio. Look for her stories on culture and the arts on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz.
O Ukahoolami, o Hawaii.
Beautiful beachside living is how one ad describes the suburb of Waikiki. Oceanfront property with an unobstructed view of the ocean sells for under $1 million. And this neighborhood features the gorgeous Waikiki Beach that residents say is perfect for a morning swim without any crowds. On its main thoroughfare, you'll find a shopping center that's home to more than 20 specialty shops and businesses, including Chicken Treat Waikiki, Turbo Sushi, the Waikiki Village News, and Woolworths. Remember Woolworths? Yes, Woolworths on Kalakaua closed decades ago, but the Waikiki we've been talking about isn't the one on Oahu. There's another Waikiki thousands of miles away. For today's quiz, we want to know, where is it? Give us the city and the country where this Waikiki is found. Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag from HPR.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are working to provide affordable housing programs to transition renters into homeowners, such as Hawaiian Community Assets. NareitHawaii.com.
Nonprofit public media is essential to our vibrant communities across the Hawaiian Islands. Hawaii Public Radio provides trusted information, poignant and diverse storytelling, and unexpected music discoveries. When you give to HPR, you're supporting informed and engaged communities that remain curious about the world. Donate today at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Furniture Plus Design.
Now it's time to head out to hear how food prices are affecting you. We want to know if you've noticed any changes in prices or availability of your favorite items lately. What's in your cart? Well, the conversation C.W. Gibson recently connected with a few shoppers braving a busy Saturday outside of the Costco in Honolulu. He ran into one young shopper at a pivotal moment in life.
Yeah, Michelle, and we live in town.
What's in your cart?
We have kimchi, lemons, spinach, blueberries, carrots, tomatoes, pretty much like your everyday, like what we're going to need for the next couple weeks. Yeah. We just moved into a new place because we just got married. We just got married a week ago.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Really, congratulations. What an exciting stage. Well, so as you start out into this new married life, have you noticed anything over the last few months in terms of difference in price points for the stuff you buy at the market?
Well, honestly, so I'm coming from California and everything is significantly more expensive here. But I do notice is that sometimes there's things that run out. My trusty Kirkland Greek yogurt was out today and I had to get something different. I am really looking at purchasing things like seasonally now. I do have to be a lot more mindful. Part of it is like our transition into married life too, but just really looking at what's on sale and building our meal plans around that, as opposed to like before we would just kind of look at what we were craving and we could make it. But really we're building meals around what's on sale, to be honest.
That was HPR's D.W. Gibson, who spoke with a newlywed Michelle outside of Costco recently. How's the state of the economy affecting your shopping habits? What's in your shopping cart? Where should we go next? Leave us a voicemail at 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation, and I'm Catherine Cruz, and we've got the pesky but pretty red-whiskered bulbul for today's Manu Minute. The recordings you'll hear are courtesy of Zeno Canto and should sound familiar to our Oahu listeners. Here's University of Hawaii Hilo Professor Patrick Hart.
The red-whiskered bulbul is one of two bulbul species that are commonly seen on Oahu. They don't actually have red whiskers, but they do have a bright red patch of feathers on their cheeks below their eye. They also have a sharp black crest on their head, a bright white chest, and are arguably prettier than their duller and slightly larger cousin, the red-vented bulbul, that can be found in similar areas. Both were accidentally introduced as escaped caged birds, possibly when a large tree fell on their aviary in Makiki in the 1960s. Their high-pitched warbling song can commonly be heard as part of the dawn chorus outside your window in the morning in many places across Oahu. Red-whiskered bulbuls are native across southern Asia. They eat a wide variety of fruits that people grow in their yard, like papayas and bananas, as well as nectar and insects. They can also spread seeds from invasive trees like Myconia into our forests. Because of this, they're considered a threat to agriculture and are on the Hawaii Injurious Wildlife List. Fortunately, they're still only found on Oahu, and many farmers and gardeners on the other islands are happy to keep it that way. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Ken and Patty Kupchak for the Friends of Oahu National Wildlife Refuges, devoted to helping protect the native species that call the refuges their home. FriendsOfOahuNWR.org.
Now it's time to reveal the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier we told you about a Waikiki located thousands of miles away from the one on Oahu. The Waikiki here in the islands means spouting waters, as streams in spring once fed wetlands that surrounded the area. The other Waikiki got its name from developers in the 1970s. In addition to sharing a name, the two neighborhoods both are located next to the ocean, the Pacific Ocean and the Indian Ocean, respectively. Both were home to Woolworth's department stores. The Woolworth's on Oahu closed in the 1990s. But the one in the other Waikiki is apparently alive and well. As for where this mystery Waikiki is located, according to a 1 5-star online review, this doppelganger Waikiki is simply the best, better than all the rest. Having lived in 3 other areas, I found that Waikiki simply has it all. Yet it is quite far from Perth City. But then, should that affect the rating of a place? I don't think so. Well, if you're of the mind to get a t-shirt from Woolworth's in Waikiki, all you need to do is make travel plans to visit Waikiki on the outskirts of Perth, Western Australia. That was the answer we were looking for, and we stumped you on that one. No winners today. But that's our quiz. If you have an idea for one you'd like to share, write to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org. The waters around Hawaii are said to be nutrient poor compared to other places. Today we take a look at research underway looking at the health of migratory humpback whales. Specifically, what can be learned from whale poop? Ryan Boss is the lead author of a new preprint looking at whale gut microbiomes in California and Hawaii. The research hasn't been peer-reviewed yet, but shows a stark difference between the gut health of whales feeding off the coast of California and those in Hawaii, where for many years they were thought not to eat. The Conversation's Maddie Bender spoke to Boss about his team's new research, starting with some potty talk.
Let's talk about methods, because, I mean, one of the first things I wondered when I read this preprint was, how do you collect whale poop?
The cheeky answer to give, or that I've been sharing with my friends and family, I say a thin napkin and an ice cream scoop and you have the intern do it. But that's not at all the case. That's just me being cheeky. But this is a method that I believe was established by Joe Roman, our collaborator. He uses what's called a plankton net. And he basically tracks this plankton net, which was originally adapted to sieve plankton out of the water column, and he drags it through surface waters, and he will capture the stool after seeing a whale defecate or seeing this in the water column.
Wow. So you need to be tracking the whale and then see it defecate or see what you think is whale stool, and then you need to go by and scoop it up. I imagine that involves a lot more monitoring than you would think.
Yes, I agree with you. I've personally never been out to do the sampling, but I think it takes a lot of work and you're out in the hot sun doing so. The one thing that I would add is that it's very important to be able to link defecation from a specific whale to the whale that's actually defecating, because you get a better view of not only the characteristics of the whale, but also when you look inside, what's going on. And if you don't know who it's coming from, you might have a sample that comes from a calf, for example, which would have a totally different gut microbiome and has been shown to in recent publications than a mature whale.
And so one of the interesting things to me when you sequence these stool samples is that in the whales that weren't known to actively feed, so the ones that might be in Hawaii, you see markers that might be consistent with things like inflammation or even gut disease. So share a little more about that.
Yeah. So after seeing that the whales canonically thought and known to fast off the coast of Hawaii there had this genus or genera that are associated with irritable bowel syndrome or metabolic syndrome, think in inflammation in general in this fasting whale, we begin to dive a little bit deeper into the genes that are actually present, the functional metabolism, if you will, the functional metabolic potential. And the genes that are there suggest that these whales are potentially more prone to disease or gut dyspepsis when they're migrating or when they are on these breeding grounds, when they're not feeding or significantly reducing their organic matter intake. We see that there are genes specifically used to lyse the tissues from these whales, or have been shown in other settings to do so. And there's also evidence that these pathogens in the fasting whale might even steal host oxygen from these whales in the lower digestive tract. But a really important observation that we made was that there's a clear difference in the canonical anaerobic and aerobic, so no oxygen and oxygen, in the fasting whale gut microbiome. And what that suggests is that as these whales reduce their organic matter intake, the food that they're eating, or fast altogether, that there might be small amounts of oxygen that linger in the digestive tract. And that's something that we don't see in the whales that are eating. And that's simply because organic matter burns oxygen. The bacteria that utilize it pull oxygen from the surrounding environment. I think we're just at the tip of the iceberg here, so to speak. We're just cracking the ice. And a caveat to all of this is from one sample. What we need are more samples to get a clearer illustration of what the baseline is for these whales that are feeding up in Alaska than what the baseline is in Hawaii, where they are known to fast, and then some more samples from other breeding grounds where these whales are eating throughout the year. But it does raise this possibility, and I think a likely possibility, that these whales, as they go to breed, are more prone to disease. And it's possible that upon foraging again, the gut microbiome can return to a healthier baseline. And this is something that we see that occurs in humans.
And I imagine that has, for instance, conservation implications of, if you know when whales are more susceptible to disease, you can have better protections or closer monitoring.
I think that's a terrific idea and something that I think I and collaborators will continue to work towards.
What are you interested in studying right now? Like, what are the most pressing scientific questions that you're in the process of answering?
With humpback whales. So I want to throw this in there because I've been thinking about it a lot lately, and that's the enormity of humpback whale gut microbiomes globally. And we can make some very reasonable assumptions and use data that exists on the number of humpback whales that are mature out there. And the most recent estimate that I'm aware of is 2018, and there's roughly 80,000 mature humpback whales. We can also assume, to some degree, the number of gut microbes that are in these mature humpback whales. And the best data that we have is from mink whales, which are smaller. And that's been estimated to be about 10 to the 15th microbes per whale. We can begin to extrapolate or provide a first order crude estimate of how many gut microbes there are in humpback whale gut microbiomes globally. And if you do that and you stack them end to end, the number of microbes, it's a vast distance. It spans far beyond where our sun is at of how many microbes are in there. And it's about 10 to the 19th. So a lot of the work that I'm doing right now is asking those types of questions. Just how many gut microbes are there in humpback whales? And what's more fascinating to me is that we see so much taxonomic novelty. We have all of these new species that are in there that we have data to suggest are there. And we're just beginning to understand them right now. So not only is it a massive gut microbial reservoir in humpback whales, but also we don't know that much about them. That's what we're working on doing next.
Yeah. The idea that there are all these potentially new species of microbes that have been living in whales this whole time is fascinating. Is there anything else that you want to add or anything that you would want listeners here to know?
Growing up, I was just so excited at seeing others discover new species. And as a deep sea ecologist, you go out on the boat and you see all throughout the world that there's new species discovered on every dive. There's just such incredible biodiversity out there. So that's something that's always been fascinating to me. And seeing firsthand in this data set that only 1% of the sequences that we have are matching something in our most exhaustive database is stunning to me. And it makes me want to come back for more. It's a very exciting time in the marine mammal community, and I'm very proud to be a part of it. I'm very thankful for our colleagues and collaborators. This study in particular, I think, is a testament to persistence and the efforts of the many. This goes back to 2010, where this sample was originally collected by the Hawaii Marine Mammal Consortium, in particular, Chris Gabriel and Suzanne Ying, who are co-authors on this paper. And then Michael Fischbach with the Great Whale Conservancy collecting the samples in the Gulf of California. So I'm very thankful for our team and the story we've come up with. And I think that others in the marine mammal community will be as well.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you again for the invitation and for having me.
That was researcher Ryan Boss of Harvard University, and HPR's Maddie Bender will have links to Boss's team's work on humpback whale microbiomes on our website later today. You know, we're planning to be on the road tomorrow, broadcasting live from Waikiki Beach as we ponder the impacts of coastal erosion on the world-famous destination. It's part two of our On the Edge series, and we thought we'd refresh your memory about the dual threat of sea level rise and of erosion. We first met University of Hawaii researcher Shelley Habel a few years ago. She'd been flying drones for a project studying the impact of king tides on our shoreline. We connected with her earlier this year as she fished out specialized equipment from the Alawai Canal to study flood inundation. She tells us that her research over the years has tracked high levels of fecal bacteria correlating to high visitor counts in Waikiki hotels, which makes you wonder how it's getting in the canal. Habel is a hydrologist and geologist with the university's Climate Resilience Collaborative. So we honoho our story from earlier this year where we shadowed Habel in the field. She's partnering with the Honolulu Board of Water Supply to study the hidden threat of rising sea level, looking at groundwater inundation in Waikiki.
We are here in the middle of Waikiki at Centennial Park, and we're Royal Hawaiian Avenue and Seaside. So, like, who knew that we had this ground monitoring well?
So this one's right in the center of Waikiki. So this one kind of is one we rely on to tell us kind of the conditions of the water table throughout Waikiki. We have a couple of other ones, but this one is kind of special just because it's right in the center.
Okay. All right. Well, go for it.
All right. So this is a pipe that penetrates into the ground down to the water table.
How far down is it?
Okay, well, we'll check right here. I have a groundwater monitoring device. We'll just lower it down. So it'll beep once it hits the water table.
Okay, so this is a cable on a spool that you're just dropping down into this tube.
Here we go. When it beeps, that means it's hit water. We can see that it is about 1.3 meters below the ground surface, which is about just over 4 feet.
Okay, and so what does that tell us?
So we know that by looking at these groundwater wells, we can see how the groundwater table goes up when the tide goes up. It also increases when, you know, we get a bunch of rainfall and that water percolates down into the ground. And so it tells us the dry space we have between the ground surface and water. And so it's influenced by the tide. Therefore, as sea level continues to rise, it elevates that base elevation. And so it kind of shrinks that dry space below the ground surface. And so at first, as a knee-jerk reaction, you kind of think about, like, when the water table reaches the surface, it'll cause damage, because that's when you start to see the flooding and water problems, things like that. But actually, there's this whole network of underground infrastructure that the water table reaches first.
So we're talking the sewer pipes and the water pipes and the storm drain?
Exactly. And you don't exactly see a lot of electrical wiring on telephone poles around here, right? So a lot of that is underground.
By design.
By design. And so as groundwater becomes elevated, it starts to cause underground flooding. And when you have things like metal pipes being bathed in this water, it starts to increase the rate of corrosion. And this water, it's not like pristine, like clean water that you drink, things like that.
Brackish?
It's brackish. So it's a little bit salty. And so that saltier water starts to corrode that underground infrastructure even faster.
And so what have your studies shown since you've been monitoring this?
Well, they've shown that, as expected, the groundwater is influenced by the tide and rainfall. And so we build models that kind of replicate where the water table is across our study area, which here is Waikiki. And we can use our models to apply expected increases in sea level. And so we can start to understand how deep the water table is, and we can compare that to where underground infrastructure is. And then we can start to look at where that water table starts to come up above the ground surface. And the water is known to be contaminated by things like sewage and other types of contaminants. And so as it reaches the ground surface, it produces a public health concern.
So do we have a handle as to how shallow those pipes are? How far down are they?
They can vary from, you know, several feet down to just a foot down. So it really depends.
Wow. Okay. And so is there any particular area that you can say is more at risk just because of the rising sea levels? Like, what part of Waikiki is it more? Diamond Head side or Evaside?
It's actually more Evaside. So that whole area just historically used to be fish ponds and things like that. And then that area was filled as part of development projects. But it's still naturally really low-lying. When it was filled, it wasn't filled very much. And so those are just naturally the first places that start to flood as groundwater emerges. And we're starting to actually see that over in Mapunapuna. Our models do
stimulate groundwater emergence in that area. And we've worked with geochemists at UH to use tracers to determine that groundwater is actually emerging.
And we're not too far off from the Olawai Canal. What's the connection there?
Yeah, like underground, if you can imagine, like, there's a level of the Olawai, there's a level of the ocean, and it penetrates right through that ground, right through that soil. Just like if you had like a cup of soil and poured water into it, it's going to rise, right? It's going to, all those little pores are going to get saturated by the water. And so it exists at a level that's basically equal or a little bit higher than the Olawai.
Is it basically saturates than the ground that we're talking about we see around the Olawai?
Right, it does.
So really then you're monitoring it because we need to figure out what is our strategy for these underground utilities and you know, how do we deal with this as the creep comes this way?
Exactly, and it's underground utilities and also basements throughout Waikiki.
And then are we hearing any reports from any hotels or condos along the shoreline?
Yeah, so groundwater inundation into basements in Waikiki is a widespread problem.
And how are the owners, the property owners, dealing with it?
They're dealing with it by pumping. They're dealing with it by wrapping some of their like structural beams inside the building, and they're also elevating the ground floor in some buildings that I've seen.
What else do you think would be important for listeners to know as we try and understand what's happening with rising sea levels? I mean, we see things on the shore, we see the sand, you know, erode away, we see sidewalks collapsing, and there's work to try and, you know, remedy that. But what else should we drive home to our listeners?
I think just that sea level has been rising. I think there's a misconception that sea level will rise but is not rising now. But if you look at the Honolulu tide gauge and other tide gauges around the state, there is a trend of sea level rise that's been ongoing for since records began. And in Honolulu, those records began even before World War I. So those are very long-term records.
And we've had some like sewer breaks.
That kind of breakage, it has been connected to shallow groundwater in not just here, but in various places around the world. So as that groundwater rises, it's influenced by the tide, and it can cause like soil grains to become unsettled. And so that structural support of infrastructure is kind of compromised. And so that, among other things, can cause things like water main breaks.
But that's all connected?
It can be, definitely. Mm-hmm. All of these things can exacerbate that kind of damage.
We've been hearing from University of Hawaii researcher Shelley Habel, whose expertise is in geology and hydrology. The story first aired in February during our first On the Edge live broadcast in Waikiki. Residents at the other end of Waikiki are also grappling with the impacts of sea level rise and coastal erosion. The Conversation's D.W. Gibson recently spoke with Jess, who was out in front of the Sheraton Waikiki Beach Resort. She's been working for a Waikiki catamaran company for about a year.
Any interesting observations? Because this is a pretty critical point in terms of where the beach walk ends if people can't gain access. Is that an issue that comes up a lot?
Yeah. Because the beach, I mean, it's washed away and we don't know if they're going to rebuild it again. So people definitely always ask questions, but the ocean can't do much, I guess.
Yeah. And do people sort of get frustrated with the sort of the inability to walk straight through or,
Some people do. Others, I guess they've been here before, so they kind of know that there was a sidewalk, but they're surprised when they see that it's gone. They're like, and then they question us, like, why? Why did that happen? Like, I mean, it's, you know, life. Natural disasters happen. You can't control anything like that. But yeah, you have good, some people are like nice about it, and then others are like concerned, like we have something to do with it. But you know,
yeah,
it is what it is.
So you worked here for a year. Have you, is that how long you've been on island? Are you from here originally?
No, I'm not. I am originally from Fiji, but ooh, I've been on island about 7 years now.
Well, so in that 7 years, do you have memories of how this, even before you were working here, maybe as a visitor, how this area has changed in terms of access?
Not that I've been here in the past 7 years. I mean, but this whole year that I've been here, it has drastically, like the beach will be up high and then another day it'll be like so far low just because of the tides. And then even like out swimming, you know, sometimes closer to shore, there's like more sand. And then like yesterday I went and you had to actually be closer to the shore to be able to stand. So that's because all the sand's coming back up. And then when the high tide comes, it all gets washed back down. So
when I see this wall here, the hotel's put up, is there ever any times when the water sort of comes close to breaching the barricade that's here?
It actually does. So you'll probably, if you hang around longer, you'll probably see it's like tides peaking right now. The most I've seen it was, I'd say, summer last year. It came over the walls and literally all the way up to, like, the bushes, or through the bushes. Now and then, like, every other day, so when high tide comes through, you'll see him, like, coming through the cracks of the walls. But, yeah.
That's pretty close. That's a space of about 10, 12 feet.
Yeah. Yeah. This whole sidewalk gets filled up. It's like a little lazy pool once it gets, you know, super king tides. So here and there, it's shocking. I mean, you know, seeing the tides come up so high, because you never know what, you know, the next year is going to look like. I mean, that's just a year change. It hasn't been so bad since this year started, but knowing what happened last year, knowing like this year, it's the new year and, you know, new things could happen. It's kind of concerning, but I don't think it's scary. I mean, it could be. It honestly could be, you know, if you really think about it. Yes, it's scary. It shows that climate change is happening and it's real. And, you know, we're just an island, but for right now, I mean, it's kind of cool just sitting here watching the waves crash.
For now, I agree with
you. Yeah, for now, until it gets worse.
And we also heard from Thomas, who for decades has been fishing off of the Fort DeRussy groin in front of the Outrigger Reef Waikiki Beach Resort on Oahu. He's noticed some significant changes over the years.
You know, everything's a little higher. Everything's more intense. This place is 60 years old. It's, you know, understandable how it's failing, but it's to be expected. None of this stuff was naturally here, so the course of erosion is going to happen repeatedly. It's a constant battle. They bring the sand in. The sand, it's great. The tide brings it out. Every 10 years, they got to replenish it. It's nice when they bring it back. The tourists appreciate a beach to lie on. It's where everyone wants to be, and unfortunately they built close to the edge of the water and that little strip is eroding, so it's a bummer for the tourists, and it doesn't affect the fishing. It's so slow, and over time fish get accustomed to it. Everything does.
So you've seen that sort of rotation over time, like bringing his hand in, sand eroding away, bringing it in again.
It's a cycle. And oh,
he's reeling one in.
Little guy.
That's beautiful.
He'd be on the dinner table, but can't keep that going. That's
what kind of fish is that?
Papil, Jack Trevally. Beautiful little fish.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. So, and have you noticed anything on the pier here? Like, does the water come up higher on the pier?
I mean, every year it's a little higher every year. It's surf dependent. Surf brings the swell and the height up a lot larger. It's just higher and higher.
Well, we have been hearing a few voices from the shores of Waikiki, where we'll be broadcasting live tomorrow. It'll be part two of our On the Edge series, hearing from officials and community members who live and work in Waikiki. Join us. Well, we have to go now, but up tomorrow, we hope you will join us as we go on the road with the conversation. Give us some feedback. Leave it on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find our archive shows online or by searching for The Conversation on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.